Hi, volleyball fans, and welcome back to Volley Talk, the podcast created for volleyball lovers who want to dig deep into what is going on in NCAA and international volleyball. I'm your host, Sarah Pavin. I'm an Olympian, beach volleyball world champion, former Nebraska Cornhusker, and a longtime pro, both indoor and on the beach.
And I'm Adam Schultz, former indoor player, international volleyball coach, and stats guru.
I love that name for you. It was a wild week in NCAA volleyball, and we're excited to share our thoughts on some key matches, in particular, a couple of interesting ones from the Big 12 and the Big 10. Let's get started. Like we said, it was a little bit of a wild week this week in NCAA volleyball. To kick things off, number 25 Auburn will likely drop out of the top 25 rankings because they lost to two unranked opponents. They lost in 5 to Alabama and in 4 to Tennessee. So I think we're going to see a switch up at the bottom of those top 25 rankings this week. Number 24 BYU beat number 20 Utah 3-2 in what was another interesting match.
Well, surprisingly, Utah had their two lowest hitting percentages in the sets they won, hitting 191 and 130 in sets 2 and 3 respectively. BYU had their lowest hitting percentage in those sets as well, but that makes a little more sense given that they lost.
Yeah, that was pretty wild when I was looking at the stats. I'm like, you literally won the two sets where you hit the worst.
Well, it was also interesting because Utah had a higher hitting percentage as a team in the fifth set as well and still lost that match. So, I mean, there were other things going on. They had 17 service errors. They were outblocked. They dug roughly the same, but they were just more error-prone at key times than BYU was.
We saw a lot of swings in momentum in that match. And especially at the end of the fifth set, I recall Utah being up 10-7, and then it was like 13-10 or something like that.
Yeah, and for me, the biggest part of that story was Utah's outside hitters went 145 on 110 sets. That's just not going to cut it, because you had Claire Little for BYU hitting 289 on 50 swings.
That's fair. Claire Little and Ellie Mortensen did lead the way for BYU. They had 18 and 17 and a half points, respectively. We saw the same point totals from the top two scores for Utah as well in Emery Satuala and Cameron Gabadlo. But as we said, the point swings, the lack of consistency, I think it kind of told the story there. The other thing that I think is so crazy was how high BYU and Utah were passing.
Well, knowing that the BYU coach was a protege of the Utah coach, it kind of made sense. But the sheer number of overpasses in that match from both sides, which doesn't really show up on the stat line anywhere, was staggering. And that's a byproduct of trying to pass like that.
Like, if you're passing with tempo, it allows for a little more wiggle room as far as precision goes on the pass. When you're trying to make your pass hit such a high peak and then fall perfectly at that 2.5 position, it's hard.
Well, and Utah specifically had a tough time getting their middles going, and I attribute that to the high pass as well. It's hard to find your timing when you're looking for the ball and it's dropping and to be in the air at the right time. I don't understand the strategy, but I don't know that those teams intimately enough to criticize, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, as you said, the timing for the middle attackers on passes that high are so challenging, and we saw so many overpasses. But it was an entertaining game nonetheless. The BYU fans were rowdy as ever. So yeah, love an in-state rivalry matchup.
Lots of emotion, lots of cheering. The BYU fans were going crazy.
In other news, number 3, Penn State had a decisive 3-0 victory over number 14, Minnesota. I must admit, I expected a lot more from this match, but Penn State just looked to be on a completely different level than Minnesota.
Minnesota looked disjointed. They hardly ran the middle. Julia Hansen had 11 kills and hit 345 for Minnesota, but that's really the only bright spot offensively that was there for the Gophers.
It just did not look smooth. Things were not flowing. As you said, they had just one heck of a time running the middle. Defensively, they blocked decently well, but I was disappointed. I don't know. I had such high hopes because I saw Minnesota play Wisconsin earlier this year. I saw them play Purdue. There's a little more firepower. It's almost, it looked just so flat.
Well, you kept expecting them to get it going. Like, they would have three or four good plays in a row, and you would think, okay, they've got the momentum. You know, this is going to stay close. They're going to keep playing well. And then they drop 4 or 5 points in a row on silly mistakes, and they just never found any consistency in that match.
There, given how the match was going, there was honestly no need for any big-time production from anybody on Penn State. But Jess Merzlik had 19 points, and Cameron Hannah had 12. Their lowest hitting percentage in, like, each individual set was 233, which is very good. But in the third set, they hit 395 as a team. We were talking last week about Utah playing Baylor and having a 391 hitting percentage. Enough said. 395, you are just, like, a well-oiled machine at that time, and you're basically unstoppable. So that pretty much sums up the Penn State-Minnesota match. Another match that I was really excited for and had very high hopes was number one Pitt playing number five Stanford.
This match, again, was disappointing. I thought there was going to be more to it. Stanford did not look good. They hit 065, 071, and 133 in their three sets. Those, the scores weren't even close.
At least they were getting better set by set.
I mean,
I think that's the only...
that, if that's the takeaway, that's the takeaway. On the flip side, Pitt hit 308, 276, and 351. It's not even close, and the scores dictated that. There was no match there to be seen.
As the scores were rolling in, I was just... my jaw was hitting the floor. I thought that this would be like a barn burner, you know? I love a top 10 matchup. Give it to me all day. This was a literal steamrolling.
I mean, Stanford, they had one player who played well. Jordan Harvey hit 368 with 11 kills. But their outside hitters, 9 kills, 11 errors on 39 swings combined. That's just not good enough when you're playing a top 10 matchup.
Yeah, you definitely need more production from your outsides. But Pitt was solid.
Yeah, I mean, Babcock was good again, 17 kills, 361. Stafford was good, 12 kills, 208. And Kelly had 4 kills and 7 block assists. Like, they were just solid all the way across their team.
Honestly, though, I don't think that this loss will really impact Stanford too much from a rankings perspective. I think they'll still be pretty high up there. I mean, you played the number one team in the country. But I will say it was nice to see Pitt come out and dominate after that questionable performance they had last week against SMU. You could tell they, like, took it personally. They're like, we are not messing around here. And that is what you expect from the number one team in the nation.
Yeah, and we talked about that match against SMU being maybe a bit of a wake-up call, tune things up, and this was the perfect match to do that. We also saw Wisconsin beat Oregon 3-1, and Boston College pushed Florida State to 5 this week.
Lots of fun stuff, but it is time to take on our feature matches of the week, which are Kansas versus K-State and Ohio State versus Penn State. Our first feature match of the week takes us to the Big 12, where number 8 Kansas played Kansas State in the Sunflower State Showdown.
I was skeptical of this match to get started. We had a number 8 versus an unranked team, and you looked at me and said, don't sleep on this match. It's going to be a good one.
100% that actually happened. And I'm aging myself here, but I played for Nebraska when they were in the Big 12. Don't do the math, thank you. And I know how much the state of Kansas loves volleyball. Every time we went to play Kansas or K-State, it was rowdy. The people were into it. And so the fact that it's an in-state rivalry match, I thought that it could be pretty spicy. And it was, because Kansas beat them in a super tight match, 3-2.
And not only was the match tight, but all of the sets were very close, could have gone either way. And honestly, you never had any idea what was going to happen in each set.
I will say it was unfortunate. Each team had a player go down with an injury. And you never want to see that happen. Liz Gregorski for K-State went down in the second set at the time, she was leading the team in scoring. And then in the fifth set, Toyosi Onabanjo went down for KU. Both didn't look great. Obviously, we're hopeful that this is nothing serious for either player. But you hate to see that happen, especially in such a tight match.
Well, and it was kind of crazy that both of them were leading their teams in points when they went out. Gregorski had 7 kills and 9 points total, and Onabanjo was hitting 571 with 16 points and 14 kills.
Interestingly, the two middles were the top scorers for KU, which in a five-set match, you're kind of expecting that kind of production from your outsides, maybe your opposite. But I thought it was really cool that Onabanjo and Reese Patak were leading the way.
And I think that that actually bodes well for them as a team moving forward. Because if your middles are that much of a threat, your outside should theoretically have an easier night. And I will say I was specifically impressed with Patak, who, as a freshman, hit 533, 11 kills, 11 block assists for 16 and a half points. And she's going to be very good for a long time.
I really liked her, too. She made a couple of young, maybe inexperienced plays early.
Caught up in the emotion of the match, I think.
Yeah, you know, she kind of tried to steal a pass from the libero on a short serve at one point. Kind of, you know, shanked another one at another point. But she found her rhythm as the match progressed. You could see her kind of like getting more and more confident with each set as the match progressed. And like, was bringing some fire and energy, and you could see the older players on the court looking at her like, okay, I like this.
I have nothing to base this on, but she seems like a quiet person in general, and she was fired up by the end of the match.
I honestly think that she could be very good. She is very good, obviously. But I think if she continues to improve, you will be hearing her name consistently in coming years. The other thing that I thought is Regan Burns, the libero. I thought that she played an excellent game. I don't think the stats adequately reflect how good she was, though.
Her plays were timely. She would make a dig when they needed it. She would step in and pass balls so that they could run the middle. I would agree with you.
A couple tactical adjustments that I respected from KU. Gregorski for K-State was kind of going off in set one. And she was scoring the majority of her points, just swinging really high over the setter down the line. I thought Kansas was really smart. In set two, they immediately moved their setter away from her to put a bigger block in front. I understand Gregorski didn't finish the match, but I thought that that was very smart, and they did it right away.
Well, I was interested to see when they made that adjustment in the second set, what was going to happen moving forward, and if it was going to be a cat and a mouse move for the rest of the match. But unfortunately, we didn't get to see how that played out.
The other thing that I thought they did really well was they switched out their second left side. So the outside hitter number two, and they had another outside who was coming in to serve and play defense across the back row. So they started with Caroline Bien attacking and Aya Elnadi as the serving and defensive sub. Partway through the match, they completely flipped the script and had them switch roles. And Elnadi started attacking and Bien was coming in to serve. I thought that was really smart. Bien also was recruited as a defensive specialist, so she has that background. But to make that kind of heads up play and to make such a drastic switch, I thought it paid off because Elnadi was pretty clutch down the stretch.
I think that that was a really heads up play by the coaching staff. You really have to know your players and where they're going to excel, and to move someone from being, you know, serving in defensive specialist and then expecting them to hit. I know the players come in as left sides, DSs, but to switch that role in the match and for her to step up and do that, I thought was impressive.
This might not be a popular opinion, but I have an opinion about Cameron Turner, the setter for KU. I felt like her setting, particularly to the left side, was pretty inconsistent, and having that sort of side view of the court, it made it very obvious in that the distance off the net was fluctuating between being too tight and too far off. You really saw Kansas struggle early, their outside hitters, and they were missing a lot of swings outside the court. I really think that that's because with the tempo of offense they were running, they were often getting underneath the ball as it flared off the net, and they weren't able to put that spin on the ball that they needed to keep it in. You saw it kind of even itself out a little bit. It definitely stayed for the most part in that match, and I don't know if that was like more of an adjustment on the outside hitter's part, but it made it really hard for the outside hitters to kind of find a rhythm.
I saw the same thing while they were playing, and for me, this is going to be one of the key areas for them as a team as to whether they're successful for the rest of the year or not. They've got great middles, so there should be less pressure on the outsides. If Turner can get their outside hitters in a rhythm, they should have one and a half blocks, and they'll be very successful. But if those hitters are constantly struggling to find rhythm, they're going to struggle against better teams, bigger blocks. They need to clean that up if they're going to continue to lead the way.
I also don't know if this was a game plan decision or if it's just Cameron Turner's setting style, but on out-of-system balls, she very often reversed the flow instead of sticking with maybe an option that would give better execution of the set. For example, when KU was struggling to pass, a lot of their passes were behind the 10-foot line around zone 5. And I would say 9 times out of 10, Turner was forcing the long-distance slide for the middles from that point, and it was very consistently off the net. I think sometimes I understand wanting to reverse the flow to get the blockers moving and have a little decomposed block defense, so to speak. But I think if a set is executed well, even if it's overloading and the blockers are already waiting, the hitters have a better opportunity to score.
I agree with you on that. I thought what they should have done, if you don't want to load your hitters up against a two-man block, is run a back row ball. It doesn't have to necessarily score. And, you know, maybe she's more consistent in those situations in general and she had a bad day. But the coaches need to see that and go, okay, it's time to simplify. You know, the offense is not working the way we want it to. Focus on putting your hitters in a good place to score.
Yeah. The passing was not great from Kansas for the entire match, but I think she was trying really hard to go for long distance sets. I think incorporating more back row definitely could have alleviated some of that. But I think, you know, kind of pushing, if they do want to run that distance, pushing the ball a little closer to the net, so at a worst case scenario, they're able to recycle that ball and the hitter can like look for the block to either wipe off or bring it back. I think that could pay off more than running a long distance ball at the 10-foot line.
It'll be interesting to see if they make those adjustments in their next matches, because I know they have a couple big games coming up. I'm curious if you think K-State gave up the match in the fourth set. We had a scenario at 21-20 where they got a free ball and the libero made a super tight pass that ended up with them losing the point. And from there, they proceeded to bad set to the left side, bad set to the pin on a slide, and then missed set to the left side where she got blocked for the match on a bad pass. And it all stemmed from that one poor free ball execution.
I'm all for a turning point. You know that. I truly believe that that pass you're talking about at 21-20 was that turning point. Because guess what, Adam? That set ended 25-20.
You didn't score another point.
You're telling me, crunch time, you're up 2-1. You have a chance to close out a match on the road against a top 10 team. You get a free ball at 21-20 and you're going to pass that over the net? That's unacceptable. You had a chance to make it 21-21 on what is arguably the most straightforward type of play in volleyball, a free ball. And you didn't score another point in that set because you did not execute that straightforward play. And then I really think that that bled over into the fifth set because they could not recover. They didn't recover.
No, the fifth set, they were walked over.
Their serving pressure disappeared. I loved how they were serving KU all through the match. Those serves were hitting the KU passers in the throat. They looked like they were coming high, but then would drop out. But in the fifth set, after that run of points at the end of the fourth, serving pressure disappeared. Their serve receive, everything was getting pulled off the net. They could not refine their footing. And I know it sounds like such a small thing, but volleyball is a game of momentum. And when you have a chance to stop a team from keeping that momentum, you have to do it.
Now, do you think that's a case of an inexperienced team? That's them looking at thinking, hey, we might beat a ranked team. Hey, this is an opponent that we want to beat. Like, what do you think the mindset is in that set? Because not only do you not execute on that free ball, but you crumble after that.
I don't know. It's hard to say, like, because I don't know them or their team, like, personally or well. But, you know, there is definitely some excitement if you're the underdog thinking, like, we're so close. Like, you can smell it almost. And so, you know, maybe there's some, like, jitters and nerves associated with that. Maybe it's, you know, a lack of mindfulness around a play or a skill that is so easily executed. It's hard to say, but like in pressure moments, even the easiest skills, you just need to be so mindful and so focused, because then you don't want to see something like this that happened where all the wheels fell off.
It was a disappointing way to end a match that had been incredibly exciting up until that point.
I also have to give a shout out, though, to Shaylee Myers, who came in off the bench when Liz Gregorski went down with her injury. She was probably on the bench, like, seeing Gregorski playing so well, being like, okay, well, I'll be ready, but, like, she's doing a good job. Like, there's probably not a high chance that I'll be playing today. And then being thrown in a match like playing your in-state rival, I thought she did an incredible job. She was scoring points. She was serve receiving. Like, I've got to give her props for stepping up like that.
She ended the day really well. She hit 250, 9 kills, 10 points total. Like, coming in for your star player and putting those kind of points up, she did her job for sure.
It'll be interesting to see how Kansas, you know, finishes out Big 12 play. They've got some tough opponents coming up, like you said. And hopefully, you know, Kansas State will take this match, learn from it, and keep building, because they showed that they have the potential and they can push top teams. So this one was fun, and I always love the Big 12.
Yeah, it was interesting. That was the first Big 12 match that I've kind of watched all the way through. So it was good to see that level of volleyball. We watched a lot of Big 10 recently.
Our second feature match was Ohio State versus number 3 Penn State. A couple days before this match, Coach Katie Schumacher-Colley of Penn State announced her recent breast cancer diagnosis. Our thoughts and prayers are with her and her family as she battles this illness. And I just have to say, it was so touching to see the Ohio State athletes wearing the pink ribbons in their hair to support her, and her own athletes showing their support as well. This match featured the number 1 and number 2 Big Ten players in attacks per set. Emily Londot of Ohio State and Jess Merzik of Penn State. I think that this match was a perfect example of a school that chose to recruit from the transfer portal, Penn State, versus one that chose to go about the more traditional methods of building a team in Ohio State.
Now, I'm not going to lie, I was unsure what we were going to see as the match started 6-0 for Ohio and then swung to 6-6. After that, it's not very often you see a match go 6 point for 6 point swing start.
Unless it's BYU and Utah.
Well, that's fair. I guess maybe we have a way of picking them.
Yeah, we're really picking the momentum games here.
I liked Ohio's serving strategy to start, targeting the left side, Merzik. She didn't pass super well, but I do have to give her credit. Even though that wasn't working for her, she is a workhorse. She works to get outside. She hits her passes that maybe aren't the best and makes something out of it.
Her workload is large. Yeah. That's for sure. Ohio State was not hiding the fact that they were like, we are going to make you work for every point you get here. They served her, I want to say, close to every single ball.
And if it didn't, somebody poached. They didn't miss. And they came hard at her.
Is she the greatest passer of all time? No. But that being said, she finds ways to score. And there's a reason that she's the number two player in the Big Ten in attacks per set. I was very impressed with her. She has a very fast arm. She swings high and deep. She's not necessarily going for extreme angles, but she has great vision, sees the block, and is able to clip those fingertips when she's in trouble. I thought she played great.
Who do you think was better, her or Londot?
Without question, in that head-to-head battle, Jess Merzic wins.
I would agree. Which was a little disappointing is the wrong word, but I thought that the freshies for Ohio State held it down in that match.
Well, Emmy Selman was the top scorer for Ohio State in that match.
She was incredible.
We're talking, so Londot usually gets like 35% of the attacks for Ohio State. Emmy Selman, this is the first match, she got more sets than Londot did.
63-59.
I mean, still very close. And those two definitely carried the load for Ohio State. I think like the difference in the kills that those two had versus the rest of the team was just not even comparable. The thing, going back to your question about Londot versus Merzic, Merzic also hits a very good back row ball. And they run her on the right side, which you wouldn't expect from a left side attacker. They usually come out of the pipe. But I just found her to be incredibly more effective than Londot in the back row.
I was actually shocked they kept running Londot out of the back row. I thought they should have set Emmy. She was more dynamic. She was jumping well. I understand that she's been great for you all season. She's the number one player. It was just a feeling thing watching the match that set Emmy. Let her go. Give her the ball. She's scoring.
It was so cool to see Emmy Selman just kind of come into her own in that match. I really liked the Ohio State freshman. I think Selman has a super high ceiling. She's long. You know, she hits good angles. Like, mixes it up, too, line and angle. I think once she gets a little bit physically stronger, once she gets a little more comfortable with the speed of the Big Ten game and improves a bit on defense, like, she can do it.
I completely agree. And I think that her and Reese, the other young left side,
Webker,
I think that they're going to be a duo that you can build the program around. Now, the one thing I will say is you had two freshmen and a freshman libero kind of covering that angle side of the court. And there were a few times where they seemed out of sync or they weren't moving into the right defensive positions. And I thought that was one of the differences in the match, was that Penn State was making more digs, and those three, you know, maybe being freshmen or maybe not being used to how that team would attack, didn't adjust well in certain situations and should have had more digs.
I think that's fair. Going back to what you said about Reese Webker, I do think that her and Selman are a great like 1-2 punch for outside hitter combos. You've got Selman, who is bigger, playing at a higher level above the net, but then you've got Reese Webker, who has outstanding ball control. She does jump well, but the thing I noticed is she struggles a bit to hit those imperfect sets. But that's the thing. When you have an outside hitter combo, one player, you know, their role is typically more of the ball control role, and the other one is more of a point scorer. Is this a steadfast rule? Absolutely not. But that's like the traditional layout of an outside hitter combo on a team. I think those two together definitely exemplify that.
I agree. I think the setter Tooman needs to not go to Webker in some of those out-of-system scenarios. You're going to have to put her in a position where she can be successful. But overall, I thought those two did a fantastic job.
I honestly think that Ohio State's future is so bright if this group of young athletes kind of sticks it out in the program. And, you know, only time will tell if Jen Flynn Oldenburg's choices and her recruiting strategy will pay off long term. I love to see it, personally. I'm a purist. I believe in building programs. And I loved to see that there were so many underclassmen on the Ohio State roster. Of the seven players who kind of played the most for Ohio State, all of them were underclassmen except for Londot and middle blocker Riley Rader. So I love to see that. This could be another segment. I hate the transfer portal. I think it's a cop-out. But so when I saw that, I was like, yes, this for me is what college volleyball is about. I want to see this team go far. So I really, really hope that these girls stay in the program and build together.
I think the future is really bright for Ohio State as long as they're not savaged by the transfer portal.
Something that I did want to say, though, is, as we were saying, Londot receives the majority of Ohio State sets. Number one in the Big Ten in kills per set. She had 3 swings per match. Ohio State was up 14-13 in the fifth. In that rally, Londot got set 3 balls, and I'm pretty sure she tipped 2 of them. Okay, I was critical of Olivia Babcock last week in their loss to SMU, so I need to say it to be fair. If you are the go-to player on your team, part of that role is taking care of business when every single person in the gym knows you're getting the ball. It is hard. Trust me, I've been there. It isn't easy being the person that everyone knows is gonna get set and having to score anyways. Having a solid double block in your face at the most critical point in a match. But you know what? It is part of your job. Sometimes, and don't get me wrong, sometimes you will not be successful, but I would much rather have seen her go up and take big rips at those balls instead of tipping them.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. You have to swing to win at that point because nobody else on your team is going to do it. You might not be it, but you might also be the hero, and that's your job. And I thought she needed to be more aggressive.
Yet again, I was screaming at the TV being like, why is she tipping that? Like, it's okay. You're getting so many sets, you're not going to be perfect. But in those moments, you have to have the confidence to be like, hell yeah, I'm the one you want to set when the game's on the line. And if you go down swinging, you go down swinging. But to see her tip 2 out of those 3 balls on match point, that was tough. I will say, however, Mrzyk is in the same position, and that girl was ripping balls.
I mean, she put that team on her back and said, we're good. I may not be passing my best, but I'm going to find ways to score. And they did. And the other thing I wanted to say was I thought the Penn State setter was outstanding.
I love Izzy Stark. I think that she already is an outstanding setter. But to come in and lead a program like Penn State the way that she is, she's big. She moves well. I know we were kind of critical of reversing the flow when we were talking about the Kansas setter doing that. The thing is, I'm seeing Izzy Stark reverse the flow, but put up perfect sets from compromised positions. This girl is strong, okay? In the Minnesota match, I saw her backpedal to the scorer's table and jack a set to the outside, and it was perfect. There's a difference between wanting to reverse the flow and to get the blockers moving just to do it versus executing it well. And she's doing it well.
What? And she's one of those players, you look at her and you think every time she touches the ball, she betters the ball. And that's probably one of the best qualities you could have out of a setter. It was always in a position where the hitters could find a rhythm or do something of that. You didn't see her trapping her hitters or balls flaring off the net. They were always in a zone they could hit. And the other thing I thought she did well was she pushed her middles off the net, gave them a chance, and continued to keep them in the game.
And that's the thing. I think what you nailed it is like Penn State's not necessarily the best passing team out there. You do see Stark setting a lot of balls from the 10-foot line area, but those hitters are in rhythm. Regardless of where the pass or dig is, those hitters know that they can expect the ball to be where they want it. I think her future is so bright.
I completely agree. And I think it shouldn't go unstated. You come in as a freshman with a lot of veteran players on that team. You've got to work to earn respect. You don't get that position just because you show up, and I think she's done a fantastic job there in a really difficult spot.
Overall, I thought it was a very entertaining match to watch. I was surprised, given, you know, Ohio State's season that they've had up to this point. I was surprised that they pushed Penn State so hard. But they showed up, and like we said, Emmy Selman taking some of that load off of Londot played a big role in that, and it was great.
Yeah, it was awesome to see her come out and play that well, and hopefully she can keep that going for the rest of the season. All right, it's time for a new segment on the show that we're gonna give a shot. It's called Verify or Veto. And in this segment, I'm going to ask Sarah a question, and she doesn't know what's coming. And she either has to verify or agree with my statement or veto it and tell me why. Are you ready?
Okay, if I agree, I just say, yeah, verify. And if not, then I explain.
No, I want to know. I want your explanation regardless, like why you agree or why you disagree.
Okay, I'm nervous.
Okay, so the first question is, or the first statement is, Ohio State will move into the rankings by next season.
At what point in the season?
at any point during the season, they will be ranked.
Verify. I agree. I think the results that you're seeing from Ohio State this year are a product of just their youth and inexperience. They're also playing in arguably the toughest conference in NCAA volleyball. So there is a learning curve there. You're not going to be amazing right away, but I think if this crew stays together, they have the potential to be very good. So verify.
Okay. Next one. Izzy Stark will be a first team All-American this year.
Verify.
Oh, that was quick.
I don't even have to think about it. Comparing, she is just so solid. In all, like, the way that she's able to run this offense, and I've seen Penn State play a few times this year, she is confident, she's sure of herself, she knows how to run an offense, she betters the ball, her hitters know what to expect. Some of the sets that she makes from just the most unfortunate out-of-system situations, that is something that I would expect from somebody with a lot more experience. I think I haven't seen a young setter like her in a long time. So verify.
Well, I'm a little surprised about that one.
Really?
I figured you would play the field on that one.
No.
Okay, here we go. Three more teams will forfeit against San Jose State by the end of the season.
Can I ask a clarification question? Sure. Three more teams aside from the ones who have already, like if they in the second round of the conference.
Oh, fair. Let's go four matches will be forfeited between now and the end of the season.
Verify. I think that the teams that, you know, forfeited their matches against San Jose State in the first round of conference play will probably forfeit them in the second round as well. I can't see those teams, you know, having a change of heart all of a sudden. So, yeah, verify. Man, I'm agreeing with everything.
Okay, last one. We'll see if you agree with this one or not. Kansas will finish at the top of the Big 12 this season.
Ooh, this is an interesting question. I'm going to say veto.
Give me your reasoning.
In watching some other ranked teams in the Big 12, I feel like they will definitely be pushed, but I feel like certain teams get more production from their outsides. Like Utah, they're big, their outsides are very dynamic. I can see Utah causing them problems. I can see Arizona State causing them problems. And they went 5 with K-State at home. You know what? I'm just going to be spicy and veto.
All right. There you have it. There's the verify or veto.
First round. Loved it. All right. It is time for our weekly hot takes. Adam, what's yours?
So mine's less of a hot take and more of an annoyance.
But oh, I watched, perfect.
I watched several different broadcasts this week, and there's a common theme, and it drives me nuts every time I hear it. And it's putting caveats on athletes' abilities. So you always hear this. That girl moves well for a big girl.
Or that
girl scores despite being small. And you know what? It's a complete disservice to these athletes. If you're tall and you move well, you move well. You may not run a 40 as fast as somebody who's smaller than you, but you're athletic and you move well. Leave it at that. And you know what? If you're 5'9 and you can go up and you're dynamic and you rip, talk about them playing volleyball. Look at how well she jumps. Look at how well her vision is. Don't go with the generic. Look at her scoring, and she's only 5'8", 5'9". To me, seeing the hard work that athletes put into their craft to be good at what they do, that part just drives me nuts.
As a big girl, I can get behind this statement. I don't want to hear all the reasons why I'm good, but I probably shouldn't be. And that goes for smaller girls as well. It's like, we're athletes. Let's celebrate our athleticism. Let's talk about the things that we're able to do and call it a campaign. I can get behind that hot take 100%. My hot take might actually be like a legit hot take.
Shocker.
My hot take is that Minnesota's hanging on to a number 14 ranking because of only two wins. The five-set wins they had against Texas and Wisconsin. For me, the five-set win that they had against Texas in, like, I don't know, the second match of the season, it's irrelevant at this point. We saw the teams that Texas lost to. They had three losses in the preseason. It wasn't pretty. So I don't think that ranking or that win can necessarily be contributing to them being 14. And again, they beat Wisconsin. That one's fine. But if you look at their schedule, every single ranked team that they have played, other than those two, they have lost to. Oftentimes, not even close. Take Texas out of it. That was literally over a month ago. And I think that Minnesota should be ranked much lower than they are.
I think that's a fair argument.
Things just keep getting better and better in NCAA volleyball. And we have got another big week coming up this week. On Friday, TCU is playing Baylor.
And then on Saturday, we have a big day in college volleyball. It's Wisconsin and Purdue, Utah versus Kansas, and Penn State versus USC.
I'm personally excited to see Utah play Kansas. This kind of ties into one of the verify or veto questions you asked. And I think that Utah is one of the teams that could take down Kansas if they get their point runs under control. So I'm excited to see that one.
We might have to visit the veto segment again and see. We might know the answer for sure by next week.
And Adam will be like, you were wrong on every single one. This week, Louisville has a big week because they've got Pitt on Friday, and that's a 1-4 matchup. And then on Sunday, they're taking on number 12 SMU. So they took on Stanford's schedule from this past week. So we'll see how Louisville fares, and hopefully they'll put up a better fight against Pitt than Stanford did.
I hope that game is not a disappointment.
I'm excited for that one. I want to tune in live. So, like, no matter what happens, I just like watching good volleyball. So I hope that's the case.
That might have the potential to be the best match of the week.
That concludes this week's episode of Volley Talk. There's always something shaking up in the volleyball world, and we hope that you enjoyed this little fix. Be sure to follow the show to make sure you don't miss any updates, and we'd be so grateful if you'd leave us a 5-star review. Also, if you have a topic that you want us to discuss, be sure to let us know by reaching out to me on Instagram at Sarah_Pavin or at info@sarahpavin.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be back next week.
Bye.